the land they received was probably provided instead of the rations that came to workers of lower ranks. So in many cities, quite a large number of citizens worked for the main temples and the palace. They were paid and their wages were recorded. And mostly, it seems to have all gone quite smoothly. Sometimes, though, wars between the cities broke out and men were called up to fight. There was no standing army at this time, so battles were fought during the months between harvest and planting, when farmers could leave their fields to fight. War was common during most eras of Mesopotamian history, pitting one city or one kingdom against another. The palaces drew up lists of men recruited for military service. Sometimes these were lists of whole towns. They standardized arms and armor and organized a hierarchical system of generals. They even invented the phalanx formation thousands of years before the Greeks used it. This probably took away the possibility of individual acts of heroism, but it made the army stronger. If you look at Mesopotamian artworks that depict warfare from the early dynastic period, everything, at least on the winning side, seems to be going according to plan. Identical soldiers line up with their identical shields, helmets, and spears, presenting a united front to the enemy. But the enemies are always shown in disarray. They're bleeding, naked, trampled under the feet of the victors. In reality, of course, a Mesopotamian battle wouldn't have looked like this, with one side scattered, robbed of all their clothing and dead or captured, while the other side was still in perfect formation and unscathed. Battles would have been brutal, with many casualties inflicted on both sides. Deaths in battle and deaths afterward from infected wounds added to the ancient fears of chaos. But war wasn't inevitable. The elaborate diplomatic system provided a way to try to solve crises without bloodshed. Unfortunately, the lives of ancient commoners can be hard to reconstruct. They were almost always illiterate, so they didn't leave records, and their homes have rarely been excavated. Archaeologists have traditionally focused more on temples and palaces. And even when an ancient house is excavated, what can you expect to find? The structures are never complete, and that's true of all buildings. Usually, we find only the bottoms of walls or foundations. The buildings were abandoned at some point, and the owners almost always removed any valuable goods inside so that only trash was left on the floors. Then the walls fell down, the whole thing was eventually leveled, and a new building was constructed on top of the ruins. This happened over and over. So archaeologists usually find layers of ancient floors, foundations, hearths, broken pots, and food debris. Occasionally, they come across a site that was abandoned in a hurry and never reoccupied. Now, the classic case of this is when a volcano erupted, like at Pompeii in Italy or the island of Santorini in Greece. The ash preserved even fragile items and was too thick for people to recover their possessions later. So everything would be left right where it was when the eruption took place. There are no volcanoes in Mesopotamia, so we have nothing like that there. But when a building burned down, you find the next best thing. Fire would bake clay tablets, so every written document in a burned building is left just as it was, and most are as hard as bricks. The fire also carbonized wood and other organic materials. So sometimes there's evidence of wooden doorposts or baskets. And the pots and food waste of everyday life were often left there too, just where they were when the fire happened. Another window into ancient life appears when archaeologists uncover a tomb that hasn't been robbed. People were often buried with things they thought would be useful in the afterlife. Often they were dressed in their finest clothes and jewelry. So even modest tombs might contain pots of food, maybe a dagger, a necklace, or a cylinder seal. You can get a tiny sense of who this person might have been, what he or she owned and cared about. Late in 1922, a British archaeologist named Sir Leonard Woolley began leading an excavation at the city of Ur, about midway between modern Baghdad and the Gulf. Woolley had a giant team of workmen, and they found evidence of some extraordinary tombs from the early dynastic period, as well as buildings and temples from later periods of Mesopotamian history. Ur was obviously an important center. Almost from the start, Woolley's men began to uncover some tombs near the major public buildings in the city center. Better still, many of them seemed to be intact, not rubbed in antiquity. Some of the tombs Woolley discovered at Ur were much more extravagant than a commoner's burial. The excavators even found gold. Right away, Woolley knew this was going to be an important find. By 1927, the team had discovered about 1,850 burial pits of commoners and 17 much more elaborate and richer tombs. They were from the early dynastic period, maybe around 2600 BCE. Somehow, they had gone unnoticed by tomb robbers for thousands of years, unlike almost all other tombs of Mesopotamian leaders. So they were found with everything exactly as it had been when the burials took place. These elaborate tombs are very mysterious. I first read about them when I was a child. Some of Woolley's first-hand account of his excavations appear in a book I loved called Hands on the Past. It included excerpts written by archaeologists about their finds. The passage by Woolley made a huge impression on me. It was one reason I became convinced I wanted to study the ancient world. According to Woolley, some of the tombs weren't just for one person. Here's some of what he wrote. The floor of the death pit was covered with bodies in ordered rows. 6 men on the entrance side and 68 women in court dress. Red coats with beaded cuffs and shell-ring belts. Headdresses of gold or silver. Great lunate earrings and multiple necklaces of blue and gold. Amongst them was one girl who was not wearing her silver hair ribbon. It was in her pocket, tightly coiled up like a rounded tape, as if she had been late for the funeral and had not had time to put it on. What in the world was going on here? These attendants in what Woolley called the death pit had either killed themselves or been killed to be buried with the main person in the tomb. There were 17 of these royal tombs, as Woolley called them. Each one, he wrote, was the resting place of a semi-divine ruler. Now, we can't be sure who these rich people were or why they were accompanied in death by dozens of attendants. Only one of them has a name we know, a woman named Puabi, whose burial was one of the most extravagant. She was found with a cylinder seal that she would have used in place of a signature. On it was inscribed her name and her title, Nin. Nin can mean queen in the Sumerian language, but it also has the more general meaning of lady. Although it's possible Puabi was a queen, she might have been a priestess instead. There are so many unknowns. Who were the people who died to join their leader in the afterlife? Were they courtiers, commoners, family members of the dead man or woman, or maybe slaves? They were all around the same age, younger than 30, which suggests that they didn't represent a cross-section of palace employees. Were their deaths a sign of incredible devotion to the dead leaders? Or did they have no choice? If their presence was voluntary, who convinced them to die? Did they all take poison at once? This was what Woolley believed. But recent scans of their skulls show that some of them were hit in the head. Did people really just stand there in the tomb, waiting to be the next one to be bashed in the head and killed? There was no evidence of a fight, and no evidence of people being restrained or forced to stay. So did the attendants take poison first, and then, when they were unconscious, had their heads cracked? It would be fascinating to know. We might get a clearer sense of the relationship between the population and their leaders. For now, here's something of what we can reconstruct. After the death of the leader, a large pit was dug, and a one-room building was constructed at one end. Inside the building, the body of the leader was placed and surrounded with luxury goods. Outside the tomb building, the doomed attendants walked down a ramp into the pit, standing in orderly lines. In some cases, a wagon was backed down the ramp, accompanied by soldiers in helmets and armor. These attendants were all killed, after which the pit was covered up. The objects buried in the tomb would have been worth a fortune even back then. There were musical instruments, mostly lyres and harps, and chariots, armor and weapons, sculptures and bowls. Many objects were made from luxury materials that had been imported. There was gold from Egypt, silver from Anatolia, lapis lazuli, a blue stone from the Hindu Kush mountains, and carnelian from the Indus Valley. Long stone beads had been drilled right through using hand-turned drills. The precision is astounding. Every bead and pendant, and there were thousands of them, is evidence of the artistry of the Sumerian craftsmen, who must have spent months or years producing each object for the tomb. There must be a story behind every object. A necklace worn by a queen or priestess would have been painstakingly created by a palace artisan. You can imagine him hammering the gold into the shapes of leaves, delicately carving and drilling the lapis lazuli to make the beads, inlaying stones into a gold frame. Did the queen or priestess wear this regularly before her death? Or was it made for her burial? Either way, all this finery was buried underground, and no one went back to steal it. All of this suggests the Mesopotamians had a belief in the type of afterlife that the Egyptians also looked forward to, one in which you could take it with you and be as rich and powerful after death as you were in life. Perhaps the attendants believed they were going to a glorious afterlife with their leader. At this early time, there were no written records of what the Mesopotamians believed about the afterlife. But it's interesting to note that later legends didn't make it out to be a pleasant place at all. Similar types of burials were also found in Egypt and later in China. For a short time, the rulers in all three places were buried with attendants who were sacrificed for the occasion. And then, quite quickly, in all three places, the practice stopped. Later kings might have had models or paintings of attendants, like the terracotta warriors in China or the wooden models in Egyptian royal tombs, but not the real thing. We might know a lot more about the royal tombs in Ur in coming years. There's an exciting project led by the British Museum and the Penn Museum in Philadelphia to put descriptions and images of all the objects from Ur online, along with photographs, archives, and notes from the excavations. People will have access to this data, and no doubt scholars will be able to make much better sense of the materials. The early dynastic period set a pattern for the civilization of Mesopotamia for thousands of years. The religion didn't change much after that. The idea that the king had power because he was chosen by the gods remained the main source of every king's legitimacy. The language of the early dynastic period, Sumerian, was considered the language of learning and religion long after it had actually become a dead language. What changed, though, was the size of the kingdom. The small city-states of the early dynastic period would soon be replaced by the world's first empire.
Lecture 8, Lugal-Segezi of Uma and Sargon of Akkad.
The ancient Mesopotamian king, Lugal-Segezi of Uma, who came to the throne around 2350 BCE, was perhaps the most ambitious ruler the world had seen up to that time. At the time, the city-state of Uma had been feuding with the neighboring kingdom of Lagash for generations. These battles were boundary wars, fights over which kingdom had the right to control the fields between them. Lagash was usually victorious. In stone inscriptions, one Lagash king after another boasted of his victories over Uma. But Lugal-Segezi changed that. A later writer described how Lugal-Segezi swept into Lagash and attacked 20 temples, shrines, and palaces. He set fire to 7 of the buildings and did major damage to 12 others. He also looted their treasuries. Again and again, the writer tells us, the Uma king carried off precious metal and lapis lazuli. He also destroyed the statues in 2 buildings, threw something valuable into a well, and ruined the barley crop belonging to the city god. Even if this account is exaggerated, it's clear that Lugal-Segezi was bent on bringing Lagash to its knees. You can imagine the impact on the people who lived there. It must have been a terrifying time. The inscription ends with a specific condemnation. This destruction was all the fault of King Lugalzagezi of Umma, we are told, not of the king of Lagash. And the whole messy conquest was a sin against the god of Lagash. Cursing Lugalzagezi, the writer says, may Nidaba, the goddess of Lugalzagezi, the Ensi of Umma, make him bear all these sins. But Lugalzagezi wasn't done. After his conquest of Lagash, he was out to rule what he called the land, not just a couple of city-states. At this point, there was no word for all of Mesopotamia, because it had never been politically united. It was just the land. Later, it would be known as Sumer and Akkad. Then, the Greeks called it Mesopotamia, and today we know it as Iraq. I should point out that in the minds of the people who lived in Sumer at this time, the world didn't extend far beyond the valley of the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. Instead, the Mesopotamians believed they lived at the center of the world. After all, the sun rose and set at what seemed to be equal distances from them, and that put them square in the middle. They knew there was a sea to the north, the Mediterranean. They called it the Upper Sea. They also were familiar with the Persian Gulf to the south, just beyond Ur and Uruk. They called that the Lower Sea. Logically, they concluded there was a sea extending right around the land, at the edge of the world. So it would be a monumental achievement if a king could rule from the Upper Sea to the Lower Sea. No one had done this before, or even attempted to. Until Lugalzagezi, the only type of king who existed in Mesopotamia was the king of a city-state. Lugalzagezi had bigger ideas. When he said he was king of the land, he was claiming to rule all the city-states. Lugalzagezi made this statement in an inscription on a vase found in Nippur, which was thought of as the religious capital of Mesopotamia. That was where the king of the gods, Enlil, had his home. In the inscription, Lugalzagezi claims that Enlil, as the greatest god, had given him control of all the people, from the rising of the sun to the setting of the sun, and from the lower sea to the upper sea. Enlil gave him no rival, the inscription states. But the cities listed were all in southern Mesopotamia: Uruk, Ur, Larsa, Umma, Zabalam, and Der. So perhaps this achievement was something short of ruling over all of what is now Iraq and Syria. Perhaps instead, he unified all of southern Mesopotamia. Still, that would be no small feat. It was probably true, and he would have been the first. Interestingly, though, he doesn't mention conquests in this inscription. Although the later writer describes him as having destroyed Lagash, Lugalzagezi doesn't brag about his military power in the inscription commissioned for him. Instead, he goes on and on about all the gods who supported him, 13 of them. He'd been given the kingship by Enlil himself, he said, and the god of heaven, An, watched him with a steadfast eye. The god Enki had given him understanding. The god Utu had pronounced his name, and so on. He then says that everyone he ruled was happy and in good cheer. The final part of the inscription is a blessing and prayer, asking Enlil to watch over him and his people, and asking for peace and prosperity. Lugalzagezi calls himself the shepherd of his people, not the victorious conqueror. So perhaps he didn't want to mention the destructive side of things. He wanted to highlight his peaceful side. Some scholars think this suggests that he was a good diplomat who had managed to bring at least 6 city-states together as a confederation without conquering them all. Others think the inscription just wasn't the place where you'd mention conquests because it commemorated the peaceful quality of the kingdom he'd created. Either way, Lugalzagezi had done something important for the history of Mesopotamia. He'd thought of a state that was bigger than his home city and the land around it. I should point out that the Mesopotamians weren't the first to have kings who united extensive areas of land under a single ruler. Egypt had been unified under a single king about 600 years earlier and had stayed unified. The Egyptians were on their fifth dynasty by the time of Lugalzagesi. The Great Pyramids had been built. Weirdly, though, there's no clear evidence that the Mesopotamians had any contact with Egypt during this time. 1,000 years before, they had been trading, with Mesopotamian architectural and artistic styles showing up in Egypt. But in the early dynastic period, from around 2900 to 2300 BCE, nothing found to date shows that this relationship had continued. So perhaps it was a coincidence that a few Mesopotamian kings, like Lugalzagesi, started thinking about expanding their kingdoms and ruling over a bigger area. You can't help but wonder, though, if Lugalzagesi might have heard rumors about those powerful kings in Egypt. It wasn't that far away, and the Egyptians and Mesopotamians both got their building timber from Lebanon. So one might think that word could have spread, even if no concrete objects or textual references have been found to confirm contact. The Great Pyramids could hardly have gone unnoticed by any visitor to the Egyptian capital city. And you'd think that someone would have made it from the Nile to the Euphrates with a story about the immense power of the kings there. But for now, in the absence of evidence, we have to assume that two of the great world civilizations were living in happy ignorance of one another. Going back to Lugalzagesi, the last known mention of him is very different from his impressive portrayal in the earlier inscriptions. An even more powerful king brought Lugalzagesi's reign to an end. This was King Sargon, whose royal inscription states, "Sargon, king of Agade, solicitor of Ishtar, king of the universe, anointed priest of An, king of the land, governor of Enlil. He won in battle with Uruk. He conquered the city and tore down its walls, and he captured Lugalzagesi, king of Uruk, in battle, and led him in a neck stock to the gate of the temple of Enlil." This was an ignominious end for Lugalzagesi, to be brought in a neck stock as a prize of war, completely humiliated. Still, Lugalzagesi had set a precedent by claiming to rule from the upper sea to the lower sea, even if he didn't actually achieve it. And he'd united a group of city-states under his rule. His successor seems to have been influenced by this. Perhaps he wanted to accomplish what Lugalzagesi had only bragged about. So, who was this Sargon? Well, he says he was the king of Agade. This was a new city, somewhere to the north of Sumer, in the region where the Tigris and Euphrates flow closest together. Archaeologists haven't found the city of Agade yet. This area of Mesopotamia came to be called Akkad. The main language spoken there was Akkadian, which was different from the Sumerian spoken in the south. Akkadian is a Semitic language related to modern Arabic and Hebrew. Akkadian began to be written down in Sargon's time using the same cuneiform script, also used to write Sumerian. One common misconception is that Sargon's conquests were some sort of violent ethnic movement of Akkadians into the land of the Sumerians. But there had been Akkadian speakers in Sumer and Sumerian speakers in Akkad for at least as long as people had been writing. We know this from their names. Names back then were all in the form of short sentences or phrases, so it's clear what language they were in. Sargon wouldn't have been perceived as a foreigner by the Sumerians. They were used to Akkadian speakers. The Mesopotamians were prejudiced against some foreigners, like the Gutians who lived in the mountains. But that prejudice didn't extend to one another. Instead, it seems that Akkadian and Sumerian speakers were all us in their minds. Educated people, increasingly, spoke both languages. So, Sargon was a warrior king who spoke Akkadian. The inscription calls him King of the Land, which was the same title that Lugalzagesi had taken. But he also called himself something even more impressive. It can be translated as King of the Universe, And there's some debate about the translation, but the term meant something bigger than the land. Was he successful in ruling a larger area than Lugalzagesi had controlled? Sargon also states that he had relationships with three gods. Here he makes some fairly conventional claims. The gods had chosen him to rule his land, and he served them in religious and political roles. It's notable that Sargon says nothing about his father. If he had inherited the throne, presumably he would have said so. His name, Sargon, means the king is legitimate, or true king. This suggests that it wasn't his birth name. Even legitimate crown princes didn't have names like that. He probably adopted it after seizing the throne and conquering Uruk. So his name became part of his propaganda. No one could even mention him by name without basically confirming his right to the throne. What has true king been doing lately? Have you been called up to fight in true king's army? You see what I mean? Long after Sargon's reign, legends grew up around him. It was said that his mother was a priestess who had given birth in secret and set him in a basket on the river, presumably hoping he wouldn't drown and that he would be found by someone and brought up by them. This is a feature of the legendary beginnings of several men who rose from obscurity and became great heroes in the eyes of their people. The same is said to have happened to Moses when he was a baby and to Romulus and Remus in Rome. It's unclear if this was because the stories were influenced by one another, or if floating unwanted babies down rivers in baskets was a familiar thing to do in a world without orphanages. In any event, we have no way to know if the episode was based in fact. The legend went on to state that a man who drew water out of the river found baby Sargon and brought him up, after which the goddess Ishtar somehow swooped in and made him king. As I said, this was a legend, and legends don't have to make a lot of sense. It does suggest, though, that Sargon's origins were humble and that he overthrew a legitimate king, almost certainly in the city of Kish, and soon he began shaking things up. Sargon wasn't the kind of ruler who'd be celebrated in the modern world if he appeared today. Modern states and their subjects don't approve of leaders who stage coups, take power, and make unprovoked attacks on their neighbors. But Sargon was remembered by later generations as a great king. He's sometimes even referred to as Sargon the Great, which puts him in the same category as Cyrus, Alexander, Constantine, Herod, and a whole lot of other the great kings, many of whom conquered their neighbors. The later Mesopotamians seem to have almost completely forgotten Lugalzagesi and all the other Sumerian kings of Lagash and Uma, but Sargon's name and reputation were passed down for thousands of years. In his inscription, Sargon described the cities he conquered as he headed beyond Uruk. First, there was Ur, where he tore down the walls. Ur had been where the rulers were buried with much of their wealth and with sacrificed men and women to serve them in the afterlife. Then he went on to Lagash and continued down to the sea. This was the lower sea, the Persian Gulf. When he got there, he states that he washed his weapons in the sea. This was such a symbolic gesture that it captured the imagination of Sargon's successors. From this time on, a king who claimed to rule all of Mesopotamia often said that he'd washed his weapons in both seas. Sargon used much the same wording as Lugalzagesi to describe why he'd been successful. He said that Enlil did not give him a rival, but he gave him indeed the upper sea and the lower sea. This took 34 battles, apparently. So there he was, after all his conquests, ruler of an empire. Strictly speaking, this was the world's first empire. The Egyptian kings had ruled an area almost this extensive, at least in length, though not in square miles, for hundreds of years. But Egypt was one country. The people there all spoke the same language, worshipped the same gods, and shared the same culture. The Nile was a natural unifying feature, and ever since about 3000 BCE, the default situation in Egypt was that it was ruled by a single king. This was never true in Mesopotamia, which tended to break up into smaller kingdoms. Sargon's empire was full of people with different traditions, different languages, and a long history of independence. The people Sargon conquered wouldn't have felt automatic allegiance to him. Their loyalty was to their local kingdom. They don't even seem to have thought of themselves as Sumerian or Mesopotamian or Syrian. They thought of themselves as citizens of Mari or Lagash or Ur. So why should they submit to a foreign war leader who had come in and destroyed their buildings and their city walls and then asked them to pay taxes to him? How could he possibly rule them? Think for a minute about the difficulties of ruling an empire back then. Not only were many people probably unhappy about having been conquered, but communication was a very slow business. If something important happened in a distant part of the empire, something like a rebellion, it might take weeks for the news to reach the king in the capital city. Then he'd have to gather his troops and make arrangements to move them to the region and get them on the road. By the time they got there, the rebellion might have been going on for months. The rebellious region might think of itself as completely free from the empire by then. Or what if a town decided not to pay its taxes? Or what if dozens of towns decided not to pay their taxes? How could they be forced to do so? It wouldn't have been possible to punish them quickly to enforce obedience. Everything would be slowed down by the fact that there was no way to move messages any faster than a person could carry them, whether by walking or traveling on a boat. Horses hadn't been domesticated yet. People had domesticated donkeys, but they didn't ride them. We take it for granted now that we can be in instant communication with pretty much anyone, anywhere. It's remarkable, so different from any other era of human history. Not long ago, my husband and I were walking on a remote stretch of the coastal footpath in Cornwall in the United Kingdom, and we were miles away from absolutely anyone else, standing on a headland looking out at the sea. At the same time, we were texting our daughter in the United States to wish her luck on an exam, and she was replying right back as though she were right there with us. Sargon would have been astonished. He was stuck waiting weeks for messages that he had sent to be delivered, and weeks more for the answers to be delivered back to him. So he had to come up with some mechanisms to make this new system work, to ensure that he didn't spend his entire reign leading troops from one place to another, endlessly putting down rebellions. And the ideas that he came up with set a pattern for all later Mesopotamian empires, and after that, for the Persian, Hellenistic, and Roman empires that ruled this same region. Some scholars, including Marlies Heinz, a German archaeologist at the University of Freiburg, have looked at Sargon's reign as a classic example of a successful rebellion against an established order. He did a number of things that a rebel leader often does. Maybe he was the first to do these things. He moved fast in his early conquests, not giving people time to fully realize what was going on. He was quick to put previously powerful leaders into embarrassing and humiliating situations, like dragging poor Lugalzagezi home in a neckstock. He took away some of the land that traditionally had belonged to temples and sold it or used it as gifts to reward people who supported him. He resettled some people whom he had conquered in new areas. These people might have rebelled against Sargon if they were left in their homelands, but in their new settlements, they would have to focus on making a living, starting new farms, putting meals on the table, so they wouldn't have much energy left to form a resistance movement. Sargon created a new capital that didn't have any old allegiances or traditions. Power was now focused in just one place, his capital city of Agade, and he could demand the goods he wanted from around the empire as taxes and tribute rather than paying for them. This was, of course, one of the great advantages of his new system, at least to him and his officials. Enormous amounts of wealth flowed in and not much flowed out. In one of Sargon's inscriptions, he wrote, "From the lower sea onwards, natives of Akkad are holding the governorships." He was creating a new structure of government. We still have the idea of governors today, people who control a particular area within a larger country. Sargon ousted the old local kings like Lugalzagezi and put people from Akkad, his own region, in control across the empire. He presumably believed they would be more loyal to him than someone born and raised in the region. This is another characteristic of a successful rebellion, according to Marlies Heinz, the German scholar. Sargon claimed he had support of the gods in this. After all, how could he have been successful if the gods hadn't wanted him to prevail? In each region that he conquered, he said the local god had given him control there, even if he also admitted he'd fought for it. This probably wasn't entirely cynical. He probably believed it himself. His very success proved his legitimacy and demonstrated all the divine support that he had. Only if the gods had chosen him to build the empire could he possibly have succeeded. The people probably believed this as well. It might have made rebelling a little riskier. The gods might be against you if you did it. Then Sargon did a smart thing. He put one of his family members in an important religious post in the south. Ur was one of the greatest of all cities and home to the moon god, whose name was Nanna in Sumerian and Sin in Sargon's Akkadian language. The temple of the moon god was huge and wealthy and headed by a powerful high priestess. Ur might well have become a center of resistance against Sargon's new imperial system. So Sargon appointed his daughter to be the new high priestess of the moon god at Ur. She could keep an eye on things for him politically, while also working to keep the moon god on his side. We don't know what the daughter's original name was, but it would have been an Akkadian name. In Ur, she adopted a Sumerian name, Enheduanna, matching the language of the people there. She was taking on a major role. The high priestess had to appease the god, of course, and to make sure that he, or at least his statue, was fed and clothed and happy. She also had to oversee the administration of his vast estates. Probably a lot of wealth in Ur derived from the temple and its holdings. Another of Sargon's strategies for dominating the world, or at least the world that he knew of, was to have a group of soldiers available year-round. Up until this time, battles were fought when people weren't farming. The men called up for military service were farmers, and they needed to be at home for most of the year. For a few months, though, between harvest and the planting season, they could serve the king. So wars tended to be fairly short. This was okay if you were battling with the neighboring city-state over where the border should be drawn, but not very helpful if you wanted to put down a distant rebellion. In one of Sargon's inscriptions, after listing a series of conquests, he wrote that 5,400 men daily eat in his presence. Historians have speculated that these men were his elite troops, supported and fed by the king. There's a debate among scholars about whether Sargon's conquests really constituted an empire. After all, whatever name you give to the state he created, it didn't last very long. And perhaps we're guilty of buying into Sargon's propaganda about the extent of his power. But a historian at Yale University, Benjamin Foster, has made a convincing argument that it was an empire, and I think he's right. For one thing, Sargon and his successors attempted to standardize a number of things, including the writing system, and he introduced the same type of record-keeping across the empire. Foster also looked at the place names that show up on clay tablets from sites like Lagash. Before Sargon's time, these tablets mostly mentioned local places in Sumer, and they referred to some diplomatic contact with lands to the east, like Elam. After Lagash was conquered by Akkad, all kinds of new places are mentioned in the tablets. Cities as far away as western Syria and Iran, and the countries of Dilmun, Magan, and Maluha. Syria and Iran were within the Akkadian Empire, but Dilmun, Magan, and Maluha were distant lands that Sargon claimed to have ties to. So the tablets found in the ground back up Sargon's claims for his wide conquests and contacts. What he and his successors achieved really was unprecedented. The contact with foreign lands outside the empire also seems to have been more direct than during previous eras. In one of Sargon's inscriptions, he wrote that he moored boats of Maluha, Magan, and Dilmun at the wharf of Agade. Maluha was the Indus Valley, Magan was modern Oman, and Dilmun was centered on the island of Bahrain in the Persian Gulf. These regions had been trading with Mesopotamia for a couple of centuries. We know this because of the precious goods, like carnelian from South Asia, that had been found in early dynastic tombs. But Sargon welcomed the boats from foreign trading partners to his capital with the merchants and their valuable merchandise on board. This seems to have been new. Akkadian trade didn't depend on middlemen. At least one local man made his living as a translator for the foreigners. This man, Cylinder Seal, notes that his name was Sin Elishu, which was an Akkadian name, and that he was a Maluha interpreter. He must have been able to speak Akkadian and the language of the Indus Valley. For now, the Indus Valley script remains undeciphered, and so the language is unknown to us. After Sargon's death, he was succeeded by two sons, one after the other. The first one, Rimush, was faced with rebellions all over the empire, which he had to put down. This was a fairly common occurrence in the ancient world. The transfer of power between kings seems to have been an ideal time to break away from their control. Rimush's brother, Manishtushu, took over next. He too was a fighter. He put together a fleet of ships and campaigned in Magan, modern Oman. He claimed in an inscription that 32 cities of Magan assembled for war, and he vanquished them and smote their cities. He felled their rulers and captured their fugitives as far as the silver mines. So, Sargon's successors kept right on fighting, trying to expand their areas of control. Sargon, as founder of the empire, had created the mold for what it meant to be an emperor.
Lecture 9, Akkadian Empire Arts and Gods.
The Akkadian period, from about 2350 to 2150 BCE, was a time of great innovation in many different aspects of life. The kings of ancient Mesopotamia and their officials were trying new ways of governing. Contacts with distant lands introduced exotic goods and new ideas. Artisans and craftsmen experimented with more naturalistic depictions of humans and the natural world. And authors wrote about the gods with new emotion and devotion. This was a classical period for the arts in Mesopotamia. The Akkadian Empire's capital, city of Agade, must have been an impressive place. A later literary text describes it as having been almost impossibly wealthy. We're told that the dwellings were filled with gold. Its bright shining houses were filled with silver. Into its granaries were brought copper, lead, and slabs of lapis lazuli. Its silos bulged at the sides. Its wharfs, where the boats docked, were all a bustle. The boats it mentions were from many places, including distant lands. There were boats from Dilmun, modern-day Bahrain, bringing copper, ivory, tin, and timber. From Magan, modern-day Oman, came copper and an igneous rock known as diorite for sculpture. The boats from Maluha, the Indus Valley, brought pearls, carnelian, and silver, along with, amazingly, elephants, monkeys, and water buffalo. It would have been a sight to see those animals on board. South Asian water buffalo show up in the designs on cylinder seals from the Akkadian period. The Akkadian artists had definitely seen these foreign animals. Perhaps they were symbols of their faraway homeland. Having access to exotic foreign goods was a way to demonstrate your wealth and power. We see Mesopotamian kings doing this for centuries to follow. Many people living within the empire, people like soldiers, traders, and administrators, would have been exposed to new ideas, new fashions, new languages, even new and surprising animals. One thing that probably made an impression on them was the difference in the religious beliefs they encountered. But they didn't conclude that the foreign beliefs were false. When Mesopotamians met people who worshipped different gods from them, they assumed that these were real gods too. They just hadn't known about them before. Some of the gods might be useful and could be absorbed into their own culture and worshipped. Others were evidently the same gods they already worshipped, but under different names. For example, there's only one sun. So, logically, there's only one sun god. The Sumerians called him Utu, and the Akkadians called him Shamash, and the Egyptians called him Re or Ra, but he was the same god. A lot of the Mesopotamian gods had a Sumerian name and a separate Akkadian name, just as the classical Greek gods also had Roman names. There weren't any false gods in the Mesopotamian view of things, not just in Mesopotamia, but anywhere. Everyone's gods were real. Some were more powerful than others, but even the most powerful ones weren't all-powerful or all-knowing, omnipotent or omniscient. The sun god, for example, knew about everything he could see, but he couldn't see what happened at night. The king of the gods, Enlil, could try to bring a flood to wipe out humans, but he could be fooled by another god who let some humans live. A kind god could keep you healthy for much of your life, but a mean or angry god could make you sick. The safest way to live was to believe in all of the gods, and to give offerings and to say prayers to the ones with the biggest impact on your life. If you moved to a distant land, or even traveled through a land with different gods, the obvious thing was to worship those gods along with your own. It's not that the Mesopotamians tolerated other religions. It's that they didn't recognize that there were other religions. All religious beliefs were part of the same divine world in their view. In fact, they didn't even have a word for religion. They had no way to conceptualize religion as something different from the rest of life. The gods were completely interwoven into everything that people experienced, felt, or thought about. They provided the explanation for every phenomenon in nature. This all made a lot of sense. The evidence of their eyes told them that there were many gods. You could see some of them and witness their great power. The sun rose every morning, defying gravity, illuminating the world, and clearly having a life force that carried it across the sky. The moon did the same at night. Storms gathered and raged and thundered. Water sprang directly out of the ground and made the plants grow. These forces moved just as obviously as a human or a sheep or a cow moved. To the Mesopotamian mind, they were clearly alive. They were also clearly immortal. Back through as many generations as one could imagine, the sun, moon, rains, and so on had always been there and would continue on long after every person alive then had died. They were enormously powerful as well, much more so than any puny human. If a god wanted to wipe out your crop, he could do it in so many ways. He could dry up your irrigation canals, or send a plague of insects, or a flood. You had no choice but to suffer through this, pleading to the gods for their mercy. So the Mesopotamians were obviously not in charge of the universe, the gods were. And if the people's job was to take care of the gods' needs, as they believed, well, that's what they would do. Their religion wasn't about spirituality or heaven or righteousness. It was about keeping the gods happy and living to see another day. But this doesn't mean that the Mesopotamians were especially pessimistic or glum. They actually loved banquets and parties, and they had close friendships and loving families. They had something of a carpe diem attitude, and they made sure to make the best of things. Part of this attitude seems to have included an appreciation for beautiful art, such as elaborate textiles and jewelry. The quality of art and craftsmanship changed considerably during the time of the Akkadian Empire. Before Sargon's time, Sumerian art of the early dynastic period, around 2900 to 2350 BCE, was initially highly stylized. Stone statues were blocky and squat. The figures had large pointed noses and big staring eyes that were usually inlaid with dark stones. The male and female figures were shown dressed in skirts or cloaks of sheepskins that were carved from the stone in a geometric pattern of regular loops. Male figures were often shown bald and clean-shaven. Female figures often wore large hats. Relief sculptures of that early era had these same characteristics. The artists don't seem to have been aiming for naturalism. Instead, they had mastered a distinct style to represent the human form, and they used it widely. At least at the beginning of the era, the faces and bodies were all much the same, though they changed the figures' hairstyles and clothing. And the people probably didn't all have such enormous noses. That was just how artists portrayed them. Still, you couldn't tell from the art if someone was old or young, thin or fat, tall or short. During the early dynastic period, reliefs, mosaics, and even scenes on cylinder seals were organized in registers, with the figures standing or walking along a line that marked the bottom of the scene. Here again, there seems to have been a standard formula for portraying offering givers, soldiers, and so on. But artists during the Akkadian period broke with these traditions. It would be fascinating to know what inspired them. The artwork made during this period is seen as some of the finest of any Mesopotamian era. But we don't even know who the artists were. The identity of an artist himself was unimportant. What was important was the king who commissioned his work, or the god whom it was designed to appeal to. Broadly speaking, the Mesopotamians don't seem to have thought about art in the same ways that we do. It wasn't for self-expression or decoration, and although it might have been inspiring, it was for different reasons. Art seems to have been somewhat magical to the Mesopotamian mind. A representation of a person or a god was called an image, which was salmu in Akkadian, and it took on some part of the thing it depicted, almost as though it had captured a bit of the person's soul. Think of it this way. Mesopotamians had no photographers or portrait painters. They probably had little idea of what they looked like. The wealthy had mirrors made of obsidian, but most people would have seen themselves only as reflected in water. So to take an inorganic material, such as stone, clay, or bronze, and turn it into something that looked human? Maybe that was a miraculous thing. In sculpting the rock or the clay into a human figure, the artist gave it a kind of life. A ritual called opening of the mouth completed this transformation. So just as a statue of a god kept in the god's temple was the god, a statue of a king or even a commoner was in some way part of that person. A statue of a man or woman set up in front of a statue of a god could pray to the god on the person's behalf. We know this because of inscriptions on the statues. A lot of the early dynastic sculptures with those big eyes and noses were depicted with their hands in the position of prayer. They had been placed in temples to pray for the lives of the people they represented and for their families. A statue of a king could act on the king's behalf as well. Like a statue of a commoner, it could be set up in a temple to pray to the gods for the king's well-being. Many royal statues were in temples and received offerings, but the statue could also help the king rule, enforcing his power, making sure the people obeyed him. Kings set up their statues around their kingdoms for this reason, not just to remind their subjects that they existed and ruled, but as part of their system of maintaining power. Kings even sent statues of themselves to their allies and to their vassals for the same reason. King Naram-Sin, Sargon's grandson, had a treaty with another king in the east, and part of that treaty required his ally to put Naram-Sin's statues into his own temples. They helped Naram-Sin establish a presence in the distant land. This seems crazy to us, because obviously a statue can't act. It can't force people to pay taxes or punish them if they plot a rebellion. But if the people and the king both believe the statue has power, that it has a part of the king's spirit inside it, then in a way it works. Perhaps the people would be less likely to rebel if they believed the statue was watching them. In later eras, and possibly during the Akkadian period as well, people swore oaths in front of the statue of a king, just as they did in front of statues of gods. and they believed they'd be punished if they broke their oath. It's a bit like witchcraft. If everyone in a society believes that witchcraft is real, then it becomes a way to explain things and a way to deal with enemies. Scientists have assured us, of course, that powers of witchcraft don't exist. But if everyone in a society believes in them, then they seem to be real. Suppose you had a run of bad luck. Someone might be bewitching you. You want to get revenge on someone who treated you badly? Try bewitching him or her. Of course, we know that spells would have done nothing at all. But people always randomly got sick and had accidents, and these could be attributed to the success of the witchcraft. These types of coincidences proved it to be real in their minds, and the Mesopotamians definitely believed that witchcraft was real. So in the same way, if you betrayed the king after swearing to support him, and then something bad happened to you, it could be seen as cause and effect. The Mesopotamians certainly believed this about the gods. There are many prayers that survive in which people beg to have their illnesses taken away or their bad luck improved. They believed that their difficult situation resulted from the gods' anger at some perceived crime and that only the gods could remedy things. In any event, let's go back to talk about the statues that were made in the Akkadian era. There had been an important technological breakthrough around this time, the invention of what's known as the lost wax technique of bronze casting, in which molten metal is poured into a mold formed from a wax model. Under this process, a clay core was covered with wax and sculpted to the shape of the desired object. Then the core and the wax sculpture were encased in another layer of clay and baked in a kiln. Now the wax melted and was poured out, and molten copper was added. When the metal cooled, it had assumed the shape of the wax model inside the clay shell, and the clay shell was then chipped away. The sculpture was hollow and much lighter than a solid copper object of the same size would have been, so it could be larger too. The earliest lost wax sculptures in the world were made in Mesopotamia. Some really extraordinary sculptures began to be created. They tend to be referred to as bronzes, though strictly speaking, they were copper alloys. Bronze is made of 10% tin or zinc, and that wasn't true of these early sculptures. Instead, they were made of copper mixed with arsenic. But for convenience, I'll call them bronzes. Akkadian sculptors were able to make bronzes that were much more naturalistic than the early dynastic sculptures had been. And they managed the same naturalism when carving in stone, which is remarkable because stone is much, much harder to carve than the wax that was sculpted to make a bronze. A regal bronze head of a king is probably the best known piece from this era. We don't know which king it was, perhaps Manishtushu, who ruled from about 2269 to 2255 BCE, or Naram-Sin, who ruled after him. Unfortunately, there's no inscription to tell us. But no private citizen would have been in a position to commission this type of object. We know that this bronze king isn't a god because there are no horns on his head. And the way his hair is braided into a chignon and the band that he wears above his forehead, those are characteristic of kings of the time. Unlike earlier Sumerian sculptures, this one seems to have been an attempt to portray a real man with his detailed hair and beard, smooth skin, and realistic and determined expression. It's almost life-size and would have had inlaid eyes made of stone. The eyes were gouged out at some point, perhaps to prevent the statue from seeing. Quite a few statues suffered aggressive mutilations in the ancient past. Taking off a statue's head would have taken away its power, so there are a lot of headless statues. Other bronze statues from this time also reflect careful observations of reality. One is a large statue from King Naram-Sin's time. It shows a standard bearer sitting on the ground with his bare legs bent comfortably around the pole of his standard. The bones and muscles are almost visible right beneath the skin. His toes curl naturally. Only the bottom half of the sculpture survives, but it gives you a sense of what the artists of this time could achieve. It's been estimated that when the statue was complete, it would have weighed 440 pounds, a And all that copper had to be imported, as there was no source for it in Mesopotamia. Artists were just as attentive in their creations of stone sculptures. There's a truly extraordinary statue of Manishtushu wearing a long plain skirt. Unfortunately, the whole top of the king's body and his